So I'll start here with one of my poems. Ultimate ease. High on this mountain side of self, a river of ice being slowly melted by this calm and centered attention. Rocks and boulders captured, frozen by time's habits, fears, desires. This practice, practiced over and over and over again. Ice to water, water to flowing, flowing to ease, ease to utter clarity. This flow has no reference point. A mind released sits as simple awareness, knowing this centerless center as it flows towards its destiny. We came knowing that the frozen heart, contracted mind, had no peace in the changing world. So we surrendered over and over and over again. This small glimpse of ease, this small glimpse of ease, surely you have found it. It's already here. So, maybe story first. I like stories. So, I was reflecting back how in 1966 I first started meditating in Paris, and I was in this apartment. It wasn't an apartment; it was a room with a toilet, like about halfway down. And it was right next, I was at Sorbonne, and up on the fifth floor, and it had this wintertime, wow, the rain. And it had one of these, you know, glass with chicken wire in it, kind of going down. And, in the hallway going upstairs, like five stories, and of course no elevator or anything. And very small, and I really learned to meditate there. But there was one problem, you know, what I believed meditation to be. And I had written this book, I read this book by Morning Sadhu, it was called Concentration, and he was kind of a Hindu yogi. And so I got really riled up. I thought, oh, this is it. And then a friend came from, that I knew, who, he had come from Mexico, and told me about the Haight-Ashbury, you know, and that really that's where the seekers were all hanging out, you know. So I got there just in time, you know. And and then I began this journey of actually trying to figure out what this was all about. You know, I ended up at Zen Center, and you know, one of the things about Suzuki Roshi was the sweetest of all. You know, he was such a sweet guy, but they were so uptight. You know, I just couldn't, you know, at that time register. And so that's when I began to realize I had to, you know, I had to find it somewhere. You know, so I ended up in the Hare Krishna community. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, repeat, repeat, repeat. And you know, maybe love will come. And then I did that. And then I ended up down in the Santa Cruz Mountains in a Christian mystical house where, you know, the meditation was, you know, it's transcendence is really what it was, you know, go out to the next planet, you know. I got really good at that, you know. And it was also the 60s, so, you know, I had some help, you know. And but the thing was, it was all based on transcendence, you know? And so it was, how can I get into a higher state, was the function of these practices, you know? And then, you know, I remember my oldest Dharma friend, his name is John Wellwood, and he's a psychologist and has written a lot of by the way, fabulous books, you know, and I think he coined it for me. And you know, one of his coined phrases that became kind of known in the world of psychology was spiritual bypass. You know, and he sort of coined that, you know, or was labeled for it, whatever you want to say. But I could see that was really where I was going with all this. Was somehow I was looking for a way, you know, maybe that was right, it stay high forever, you know, and that this was a means that was actually available on some level. And I didn't lose that when I went overland to India, and I'd sort of really gotten into it by then. And I would sit every morning, and I did nothing, you know. But there was always that tendency to try to find in my mind somewhere to transcend here, you know. So I want to tell kind of story within this, you know. And part of it was I was actually looking for, in a sense, a mystical tradition that somehow had some doorway that transcended all of my past. Because essentially what I had done, and this is what I did, was I burned all the bridges behind me, you know. And so by the time I got to Asia, you know, from everything, you know, family system, everything was just fried, you know. And, but there was an incredible sense of openness, you know. And I still was looking for that, you know, that maybe that mystical experience that would transcend the world I was in. And also didn't want to know anything about my past. You know, that was like, no way, I'm not looking there, you know. And so this one story, because it was really impactful to me, was I decided I had to go up. I had two Lama Tipten Yeshe and Lama Tipten Zopa. And there was a cave up in, it was called Tumi, and it was on the Everest trek. And so I got a visa for 2 months out of the Nepali government. In those years, it was 15 days. So I lived there for a year. I was very fortunate to keep. Somebody was blessing me, you know, because many people were kicked out, and I seemed to just slide through. So I left Kathmandu, and there was this, you know, again, I've been kind of doing this the rest of my life, too. I took off and had this heavy backpack, and I remember I got on the bus and got this was towards the Chinese border, and I started to walk. In those days, the only way you could get there was walking. You know, there was none of this. There was a plane to Lukla, but there weren't any roads or anything. So I got about 3/4 of the way up, and I just started to cry and realized what had I done. You know, it's like there was that sense of. I pushed all the boundaries, and this was, I couldn't go any. I couldn't carry the pack for one thing, and it was so steep, and you know, but I wouldn't turn around, you know, and so there was this whole thing of, well, how do you keep moving, you know? And fortunately, I was saved by. A young man from Pamboche, which is above Tamboche, the last village on the way to Everest, and now very well, it's a big, it's probably a freeway by now. But how many in those days there weren't? There wasn't no Westerners, you know, and. And I really had this idea that somehow if I could just keep walking, you know, somehow I would leave everything behind me. And Thupten Yeshe had said to me when I said, he gave me some mantra and stuff and said, oh, you just do this mantra and you'll be safe and everything will be all right. But he also said to me something that was the most important piece to me. He said, John, just keep your mind and your feet, you know? And it was one of, you know, it's like we say things, we don't even know what we're saying half the time, and you guys go, wow, that was really insightful. You know what I'm saying? You know? And he said that, it was kind of off the cuff, because I'd spend afternoons with him overlooking Kathmandu, and he didn't buy all my transcendent stuff at all, you know? But I remembered that piece, you know, of just keep your mind and your feet, you know. So I did my mantra, I did, and I recognized that somehow, and for me it wasn't so much about what we do here in that sense, I was walking off and away from my past, you know. I was not turning around and looking at it yet, so I just wanted to walk away from it. And so I ended up walking for 2 months, you know, And I think I walked off a lot of stuff. But one of the pieces that happened to me that was, you know, my little transcendent world was, I was in this town, Jumbezi. And I came in and it was May full moon, which is also Vesak. The Buddha was enlightened. He was born enlightened, first taught, and died under that May full moon, according to whatever, you know. So when I got to Jumbezi, the head lama took me into his house. And there was like, maybe four hand-hewn boards that were kind of a bed that I was on. And then there was a wall with slats, you know, wood slats. It was light that came through them, but they were just kind of a barrier. And the lama was right behind me. I mean, so he was actually, you know, if you took the boards away, he would have been sitting right in my lap, right? And so all night long, and I had been walking and walking and walking, and I was, it was full moon, I was exhausted, and he started these chants. And as he chanted, I would kind of, I'd go asleep, and then I'd wake up and go asleep and wake up. And in that process, it's kind of an odd thing to say, but it was almost like I moved out of the world I came from, and I moved into another world. And the other world was that this was a portal, you know, in time, probably didn't have, it happened to one other person in the same village I know, quite well known. He's the one that turned Ram Dass on when he was Richard Alpert, also had the same experience there. But it was like walking through a portal, and suddenly I was, I had moved into another world, and it was actually a mythical and mystical world. And in the tradition, it was also known as the gate was Shambhala, which is what we know today, you know. But it was actually I walked through it, you know. And in that experience, then the next morning. Because it was a pretty rough night, and just kind of waking up, and the full moon, and the kind of the primitiveness of it all, that the next morning they had this huge festival in the village, you know, and all the village came together, and I was invited, and I went, and in my mind, it was not the village that I had walked into. It was somewhere else, you know. The tankas on the walls, the all of it was another world in some ways. And I stayed, and then that night I slept, and I walked on. And sometimes we have experiences that kind of break the old mold, you know. And so suddenly I had walked through this gate, and I don't know. It was kind of a transpersonal piece. That suddenly I was willing to start exploring that, you know. And so suddenly the stories started coming of all the things I had. And I was only maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks into that, you know. And I just kept walking, you know. and the stories that of my past would come, and I had the gift of in a sense allowing them, and the beauty was at that time was the walking it. I was walking it, you know. And I can't think of a more kind of healing peace that later brought me when I finally, it was probably a year later when I ended up in Bodh Gaya, India. I had been a Hindu monk, you know, with the shaved head and kind of orange robes, and you know, I had gone to all the extremes you can imagine, you know, because I wanted somehow to be free. And one of the things I knew, I didn't want my past. You know, I didn't want to be who I had been, you know. And that's 2 months of walking. I mean, I've been doing these walks ever since. Like last summer, walked for 250 miles in the Himalayas. You know, up and down, up and down, up and down. Not the same anymore, you know. But there was a determination that somehow I had to change, you know. And the change meant that I also had to turn around and own the whole thing. On that journey, I spent an afternoon with Sir Edward Hillary, and I spent 9 days with the man who skied down Everest, if you ever saw that movie. He was the most samurai person I ever met. And amazing. If you ever see that movie, you go, oh my God, this guy is, you know, I'm lightweight. You know, this guy's like, he's something else, you know. And I get to Bodh Gaya, and I sit down, and I think I told you that at night, you know, at first I just, what I had done in those 2 months, I sat down in the first 10-day retreat, I did not listen to instructions, I simply started to chronologically, even though I put a lot of pieces in this 2 months together, I then actually began this process of chronologically going back. And being able to, you know, the thing is that I read to you a piece from Emily Dixon about, you know, that in our bodies we bury material and then we don't touch it, you know, and it takes a tremendous amount of a kind of living to sometimes to let those bone after bone kind of come and be known, you know. And so the first 10 days was just chronologically getting that together. I sat for 6 weeks. The second 10 days, I just cried. You know, I went, oh my God, you know. I had been a little kid, you know, born in Kansas. Went 2 months old, I went to El Salvador and Guatemala. I was taken care of by Mayan women who taught me their language. And then at 4 and a half, there was El Salvador, there was a revolution, and, you know, my family came back to the States, and I stopped speaking. And so I was put in a school for autistic children, of course, you know. And then, so I was considered autistic, and because I wouldn't speak, you know. But it was just, you know, I know now, it was well, I'm dead, you know, I'm a few things, but, you know, the piece was that there had been a trauma, you know, and I had just turned away from it. And that was, I think, the beginning of my spiritual journey, actually, you know. And I'm sure the autistic kids, you know, I was with them for a year, and I think there was a lot for me as a little kid that I think I learned from them, you know. So the second 2 days, I just cried, you know. And I realized, you know, that kind of temple of toxins, that this process is somehow that we have to own the whole thing. On some level, it's not, you know, sort of like not forgive and forget. It's actually forgive and remember. You know. And so I went through that process, and you know, there were different incidents over the next few years, you know, that I began to get more and more comfortable with being, you know, I think all we want in this, all this practice, is to be authentic, to be ourselves. Is there anything else you really want? I mean, you'd like to get enlightened, I know that, but here's another piece, is that actually when we kind of take and present ourselves completely to ourselves, and it's really what the beauty of this is, you know, is that we like to hide from ourselves in different ways. But if you sit here long enough, you know, the water gets really still, and if there's any, you know, loose logs, they're going to, nope, and they're going to come up to the surface and cause waves and havoc, you know? But everyone that's loosened, you know, is actually, once it's loosened, it's known. And that's the beauty of awareness. Awareness actually, when it sees, its tendency is it simply liberates it, you know? And then one begins to recognize the nature of authenticity. That somehow, I just want to be myself. No, I don't want to be anybody else. I don't want to cover anything over. You know, I'm tired of, you know, this kind of internal protection that we play. You know, and we kind of give it up here. You know. So a transformation began to like start to move in me, and part of that a transformation really had to do with trust and love, you know. And I think fundamentally, you know, how this practice approaches it, you know, Sri Nisargadatta, the great I Am That. Advaita teacher, his favorite line of mine is, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And my life is somewhere between the two. You know, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. My life flows between the two. You know. And sometimes, and I have nothing for this because I know many people, you know, with Amaji and different people. And, of course, I was with Ram Dass in India with Neem Karoli and, you know, different kind of bhakti trips. And but what I came to really love was the fact that this is the first line, is that wisdom tells me I'm nothing. And in a way, we actually rely on the wisdom as a primal kind of means here. But it's not the end product, you know, because ultimately it's actually a sure heart's release, you know. And the sure heart's release is actually a kind and generous, a compassion, a loving, an open heart. That's ultimately where this is going and what it's about, you know. This is from the Venerable Ajahn Chah. When I had been practicing only for 2 or 3 years, I still could not trust myself. But after I had experienced much, I learned to trust my own heart. When you have this deep understanding, whatever occurs, you can let it occur, and all things will pass and be quelled. You will reach a point where the heart tells itself what to do. It is instantly probing, constantly mindful. Your only concern is to your need to continuously contemplate. Pretty simple, huh? You know? But I think ultimately, you know, we have to get to a point where, and I guess that's that authenticity, where we have trained the mind enough to stay out of the way, and that we begin and realize that it's dangerous, and that we actually choose to trust, and trust not so much the mind. It's still tricky, and it stays tricky, you know, but the heart, you know. And I love, like, Thupten Yeshe, one of the beauties that he kind of passed on to me, which I didn't get at first, you know, when I go and I'd sit up and look, we'd be looking over Kathmandu, and this was the old King's Astrologer's house, which now is this huge monastery, Kopan. But at that time, there was just this old green metal roof kind of flat building there, and it had been the King's Astrologer's house. And he would, you know, when he was talking, we'd get on all these big discussions and stuff, and he would go, "My mind," you know. And over and over again, "Mind," you know, and I always thought, well, this guy, you know, he hasn't studied any science or anything. So, you know, how could it be that, you know, he wouldn't know where his mind was, you know? But over the years, I realized that he knew exactly where his mind was, you know? And he did come from there. He was incredibly, the one thing that was beautiful about him was, you know, I mean, he was a trip, but you could tell instantly that this man was a pure heart, you know. He was also a wise man, but he was a pure heart, and that was the fundamentals of what was inspiring. And I can say I've had many teachers, you know, and most of them Asian teachers, and the one quality, you know, that was identifiable was you could feel their heart, you know, their sincerity and their truth, you know. And that is enough, you know. You know, I'm not so much into, I mean, I did for many years, kind of phrases with metta. And but there was a part of me that have understood it differently over the years. And it doesn't have to do with phrases, but it does have to do with an awareness, you know. And that awareness is something that really does unpack. You know, it has the Brahma-viharas, the qualities of the kind of the abiding in the great good heart, you know. I'll read you this piece. I think it's I think I wrote it years ago. I have no idea, but it's really, it's kind of, I get amazed sometimes. Spiritual practice: by uprooting our personal mythologies of isolation, uncovering the radiant, joyful heart within each of us, and manifest this radiance to the world. We find beneath the wounded concepts of our separation a connection both to ourselves and to all beings. Freeing ourselves from the illusion of separateness allows us to live in a natural freedom rather than be driven by the preconceptions about our own boundaries and limitations. The Buddha described the spiritual path that leads to this freedom as the liberation of the heart, which is love. He taught a systematic, integrated path that moves the heart out of isolation, contraction, into a true connection. The path is with us as a living tradition of meditation practice, cultivating love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These four practices are called the Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes or home. You know, I like home. You know, and so ultimately, when you know, we kind of unpack all the crap and complexity, and we uproot sometimes the ferocity of our woundings, you know, that actually I suspect sometimes, I think the wisdom's great, but I think those woundings, you know, all the things that didn't work out for you, that were difficult, and everybody here is that, you know, you all had that. That is actually the root, that to actually own that and hold your own sometimes disappointment, your own suffering, your own betrayals and difficulties, you know, that to own that, that is what makes you human. That's what allows you to touch your own heart, which then ultimately touches all hearts. So, you can, you know, the thing is, Ajahn Chah, I don't have the quote from him, but I always loved it, you know, and it meant a lot to me. And he said, oh, you don't need to do any phrases. You just need to see into truth, you know? And if you see into truth, it will break your heart and open you, you know? And that is the fundamentals here. So we get really quiet and you think, oh, we're here to, you know, to get high or transcend or I've done all that. And no, we're here to kind of own our humanness, you know? And that humanness is a sense of how can you be in the world, you know, with an open heart? It means that in essence, there's a vulnerability there, you know? And we're afraid of the vulnerability, you know, because, you know, the boundaries or the limitations or we'll be done wrong or we'll be swallowed or something, you know. But here's another kind of option behind this, is wonder if you can have the vulnerability, but you don't lose yourself. One of the truths is that we have a tendency to abandon ourselves for fear, for other, for to fix it, to control it, to some reason. And here we have to learn that, oh, you know, I settle myself in this kind of authentic heart that gives itself and it knows itself. Therefore, it will not lose itself, you know. It will, you know, it won't go to the ends of the earth to, you know, to abandon itself, thinking that somehow that, you know, it was always this fantasy. I had this fantasy too, that, you know, if I just love somebody enough, they'd love me back. You know, did you try that? You know, and you know, it didn't work. You know, but what we have to learn is somehow, can we learn ourselves enough? Can we learn to love ourselves enough to include another? You know, and in some ways, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be one person, but it has to, in some way, we have to be so in touch and connected and fearless in ourselves that then we don't abandon, but we actually include, you know. It's interesting. And I think, you know, I think particularly, this is now maybe a, I think women were taught, you know, in a cultural context, that somehow if they abandon themselves enough, that they'd be taken care of, they'd be loved, they'd, all that stuff. It's like, oh my gosh, did it work? No. It's again a cultural misnomer that was, you know, kind of passed on, you know. But the same way, you know, here, you got two guys sitting up here, right? What did we get? Especially we're white guys. You know, and you know, if you ever seen like the bulls out in the field, you know, and they have a ring in their nose, and that ring is cultural conditioning about being a guy, you know, and just like for the women, the guys have this thing, but they can't see it. You know, actually, I think it's somewhat more visible for the women. But the guy, we walk around with this thing, and we're being dragged along by our male, especially white male, cultural conditioning that blinds us on some level, you know, to it. And these are all just, you know, they're all just overlays of cultural conditioning. And the idea here is, oh, can I become more sensitive to, you know, the things that have they really blinded me to what is, you know. And I love, you know, one of the great lines from Mother Teresa, you know, was, you can't do great things in life. You can do only little things with great love. Mm. You know. And I see that, you know, sometimes, you know, I want to be a great bodhisattva, and I want to, you know, change the world and all that stuff. But I understand, little by little, that it's just sometimes I can't do that. What I can do is little things with love, you know. And if we all kind of taught each other to do little things with love, we will change the world. How's that? You know? Mm-hmm. Good enough for me. No. I love the, you know, in the practice of, you know, Bhikkhu Anilayo, he does this four quadrant, you know, but he doesn't do phrases. It's just sitting with a good heart. And I always think, oh, well, you know, it used to be I'd go to the grocery store, I'd be driving, and I would do metta phrases. I think you did metta phrases, like, all over the place, you know. And I was pretty good. I smiled at all the children, and, you know, I was polite and let people go in front of me, and I didn't get too angry or anything, you know. But eventually I realized I didn't need that. What I needed was just presence. And that presence had a natural kind of loving-kindness in it itself, you know. And so it wasn't there was a difference between a doing practice and a being practice. And I've become more and more into the being practice, you know. And not that I have anything doing practice, but just I've learned to respect it a lot more. The 11 benefits. Now, I remember Sylvia Borstein, my friend, you know, she, was it? Who was I forgotten with this? Sharon, yeah, Salzburg had her memorize these, but I can't remember. And this is the benefits from doing loving kindness practice. You will sleep with ease. You will wake with ease. You will have pleasant dreams. People will love you. Devas and animals will love you. Devas will protect you. External dangers, poison, weapons, and fire will not harm you. Your face will be radiant. Your mind will be serene. You will die unconfused. You will be reborn in a happy realm. Now, that's the 11. Sounds good? You know? I mean, it's great, you know, because we come here and we come here and we're so narcissistic. We come here and we're, you know, you see it right away as soon as you sit down, you know, from last week, this week. And all it is just this, oh my God, drive you bonkers, right? And, but it has to happen that way. You cannot escape your own mind, you know, and your own stories and your own contractions and your own kind of pains you know, your control issues and all that. You come and you have to kind of let it You know, that's why 10 days is so wonderful, to let the stuff settle out. You know, it's like, neither Dan nor I, we can't speed any of this stuff up. You know, we help you all get a little insight and this and that, but we can't really speed this up. You know, all it is, it just takes time to settle, and settling then becomes, you know, much more it goes from that personal of always telling those same, and I'm not saying getting out of them, but these same damn self stories, you know. But the ideas here are based not on the personal, but on these universal principles that, you know, that ultimately when we completely have ease and relax, that the separateness between you and me begins to dissolve, you know. And we actually begin and then kind of breaking down the the separateness that has limited us, you know. So ultimately, I like to just keep you here for a month. I'm good at this, you know, and that's why, you know, 15 years, I always taught that second month of the two-month retreat. So I had him sit for a month before I showed up. But also, I'm not doing it anymore. You know? No. I may go back to it, but, you know. And we start to break down that separateness, you know, and to break down that separateness is actually to touch in more into, I'm going to take us back to that story of that of walking into Shambhala, that somehow we break down kind of the concretized, limited boundaries we create in our type of selfing. You know, and it can open us up to, you know, this is a mystical world. This is completely a mystical world. It cannot be anything but that. You know, the only thing that limits you is your thinking. You know, it actually limits you from the fact that, you know, the stars and this is a mystery going on here that is, you know, beyond concept. You know, and that to begin to somehow give ourselves permission to loosen that structure and begin to, as that structure loosens, then this whole thing that Dennis was talking about last night of anatta, you know, and I don't know if that's explainable, but non-separateness, in the sense of there are moments where it's not you and me, it just is. And we start to rely more and more on the is, and that the is not defined, you know. And then it suddenly allows space to be recognized. Oh, you know. It's so interesting that the way our minds work is that you always go to objects. Do you follow what I'm saying here? You always go to objects. So it's a person, it's a sound, it's a smell, it's a taste. It's always the something. But what is the something happening in? No. It's actually this vast space, this openness that is never, because our minds go directly to the objects in it and the words, also objects within it, that we don't allow ourselves permission to actually sit in the space of it, you know. You follow? Yeah. No, it's you know. And the space is amazing because it doesn't do anything. You know, it simply holds everything. You know, and so to actually turn the mind away from the objects and start resting in the space, then there actually is no problem. And it also allows everything, because of its nature, in that space to arise, be known, and pass away. Cool, huh? Oh, we're getting down to liberation here. You know? It's true. So, you know, I probably shouldn't read this, but I will. You know, I always like this because ultimately, again, if it's space and there is this, you know, we kind of loosen up our limits in some ways, then we also have to see the truth of our world that we live in. You know, and I always think you are the most privileged people I can imagine. You know, 0.00000000, maybe one, you know, of all the people, you know. But then, as that separateness breaks down, we also have to kind of get a feel, understanding of the world. Now, these are old statistics. I don't have newer ones. So these are a little bit ancient, probably 15, 20 years old, but it's probably changed a bit. But you get the drift of this, you know. If we shrank the Earth's population to a village of precisely 100 people, with all the existing human ratios the same, it would look something like the following. There would be 57 Asians, 21 Europeans, 4 from the Western Hemisphere, both North and South, 8 Africans, 52 would be female, 48 would be male, 70 would be non-white, 30 would be white, 70 would be non-Christian, 30 would be Christian, 89 would be heterosexual, 11 would be homosexual. 6 people would possess 59% of the entire world's wealth, and all 6 would come from the United States. That statistic may have changed a little bit. But now it's grander than the 59%, by the way. But there may be a few more of them. 80 would live in substandard housing. 70 would be unable to read. 50 would suffer from malnutrition. 1 would have a college education. 1 would own a computer. 6% of the world's population uses 50% of the world's resources. Now, what do you think yourself of that? You know, it's like... So we sit on top of the mountain, and we have this privilege. Hopefully, in this process, this is the chance to wake up, because if you look at the statistics, and now I'm not saying there's reincarnation or any of that stuff, but let's just pretend. Let's just pretend. What would be your chances? No? What would be your chances? No? And if you knew that, how would you act? What would you do? No. What would you do? You know. It's just like genetically, you know, when we're talking about, you know, everybody in this room is going to die, and of course, you don't know when or how it's going to be. But, it's genetically, human beings are somehow, we can wake up to other things. But this particular truth, somehow I think it's a genetic thing of protection, that we can't actually know death and know that it's coming. And so, but it is the thing that if we really got it on a deep level, the impermanent reality of your death, you know, and you had an understanding of that, I suspect everyone in this room would act differently, you know, completely. You know. And that is a training. You know, that somehow owning it, which again genetically you don't want to, we know that, you know, you want to just you're going to die, not me. You know, that's the mentality, you know. But we start to own it, then that also is a game changer, you know. Just like that awareness of the human condition. No. So, symptoms of inner peace. A tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than based on past experience. Unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. A loss of interest in judging other people. A loss in interest in judging oneself. A loss in interest in interpreting the actions of others. A loss of interest in conflict. A loss of the ability to worry. Frequent overwhelming episodes of appreciation. Contented feelings of connectedness with others and nature. Frequent bouts of smiling. An increased tendency to let things happen rather than make them happen. An increased receptivity to the love extended by others as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it.
What was the name of the list again?
Just symptoms of inner peace. So I'm going to read just to kind of read my poem again. It's always different. Ultimate ease. High on this mountain side of self, a river of ice being slowly melted by this calm and centered attention. Rocks and boulders captured, frozen by time's habits, fears, and desires. This practice, practiced over and over again. Ice to water, water to flowing, flowing to ease, ease to utter clarity. This flow has no reference point. A mind released sits as simple awareness. A mind released sits as simple awareness, knowing the centerless center as it flows towards its own destiny. We came knowing that frozen heart, contracted mind, had no peace in a changing world. So we surrendered over and over and over. This small glimpse of ease, surely you have found it. It's already here. Let's just sit for a moment.